Good afternoon. I'm Kate Manahan. Thank you for listening to What Mama Wants, Less Toxics and More Health. This is a chance to hear from educators, citizens, policymakers, and scientists about the role toxics are playing in our daily lives, from PFAS to plastics and more. And we always consider what Mother Earth wants in the process. My guest today is farmer Fred Stone of Stone Ridge Farm in Arundel, Maine. Fred's been at ground zero in Maine as the PFAS story broke on his dairy farm, rippling out through the farming community, where sludge has been spread on fields as fertilizer. Because of his personal experience and integrity, Fred has become a powerful advocate for food safety. And Fred Stone is now also kind of famous, a spokesperson in all sorts of media, national and international, including most recently The Guardian. I am so delighted to have you on the show today, Fred. Welcome to What Mama Wants.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate this opportunity to, to give a farmer's perspective of things, I guess, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, we were talking about today's show. You had suggested that we start with a speech given by Paul Harvey, who's a famous radio personality, which he made to the Future Farmers of America in 1978, and it's called So God Made a Farmer. Can you say a little bit about what made you think of this for today?
Basically, we saw Paul Harvey at the American Farm Bureau annual meeting when my wife and I were the National Outstanding Young Farmer Award winners. And this was back in the 80s, so that was, I guess that was in another life, another century. And it was quite impressive and, in a nutshell, kind of advocates what we're all about on the farm. And it's not a job, and it's really not a lifestyle. Sometimes people call it a calling, but I think Mr. Harvey really encapsulates the way we feel, and sometimes it's awful hard not to cry when you hear the thing. So that's why I thought it might be a good way to start our conversation on what happened to us.
Well, great. Let's listen. It's just 2 minutes, and it's Paul Harvey reading So God Made a Farmer.
And on the eighth day, God looked down on his planned paradise and said, I need a caretaker. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody willing to get up before dawn, milk cows, work all day in the fields, milk cows again, eat supper, then go to town and stay past midnight at a meeting of the school board. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody willing to sit up all night with a newborn colt and watch it die, then dry his eyes and say, maybe next year. I need somebody who can shape an axe handle from a persimmon sprout, shoe a horse with a hunk of car tire, who can make harness out of hay, wire, feed sacks, and shoe scraps, who planting time and harvest season will finish his 40-hour week by Tuesday noon and then pain in from tractor back, put in another 72 hours. So God made a farmer. God said, I need somebody strong enough to clear trees and heave bales, yet gentle enough to yean lambs and wean pigs and tend the pink-combed pullets, who will stop his mower for an hour to splint the broken leg of a meadowlark. So God made a farmer. It had to be somebody who'd plow deep and straight and not cut corners, somebody to seed, weed, feed, breed, and rake, and disc, and plow, and plant, and tie the fleece, and strain the milk, somebody who'd bale a family together with the soft, strong bonds of sharing, who would laugh and then sigh and then reply with smiling eyes when his son says that he wants to spend his life doing what dad does. So God made a farmer.
So, Fred, you referred to farming as a calling sometimes, and I wonder, in your own life, when did you realize you wanted to be a farmer?
Oh, I guess it goes way back. I got my first brown Swiss heifer when I was actually 4 years old. So I guess it goes way back. And in the fields, running around, as farm kids usually do, and my father's doing his work. And of course, kids were always in the way, and of course, we always had made work, found things for us to do, obviously, to keep us out of the way. But then as you get older, you have your own chores to do, and then you're out there doing your work along with my father, and then you learn how to run equipment. Of course, very early in life, and I think the first thing they ever teach you how to do is to tend and rake hay, because it's pretty idiot-proof, actually. At least that's what they tell me, anyway. And that's how you graduate up through. And my wife had a similar situation and growing up, and on her parents' farm in Limerick. So, yeah, it's a heck of a thing. And you care more about the cattle and the land than you do everything else. We always said cows first, people second, and that's how we run the operation. The farm is itself says, and we're always told if you take care of the land, you take care of the cows, and the cows and the land will take care of you. And so it's awful hard these days for the layman to understand that, because now you're looking at folks that are two or three generations away from that. For me and for my wife, we are a part of it.
It's so consuming. It's so different from the modern lifestyle.
Oh, yes. I mean, and it's sad to say that I think in our situation that we'll be the last ones there, and that they'll be milking cows there. I mean.
Now, are you the third generation farmer on Stone Ridge Farm?
My grandfather purchased a farm in 1914, and then it was taken over by my father and my mother. And then in 1977, my wife and I purchased it from my father. And, of course, those generations of the grandparents lived downstairs. We lived upstairs because it was a big farmhouse, and that's how that went along. My mother was an administrator in a benefit school system, so their retirement was really tied to her stuff, so that made it a lot easier for that. And my father was probably the best hired man I ever had, and he was the one that, and Paul Harvey and Mr. Harvey is working from dawn to dusk and what have you, that was my father.
Yeah, put in your 40-hour week by
put
Tuesday
in my 40-hour
morning.
Week. And I will say that my when it came to tending calves, my wife was the only one that my father would let near the calves, because I was always in a hurry to go here, go there, and my father was one that always wanted to put in more time with the calves, and my wife was just kind of dovetailed right into that, so it worked out really well. We were very close. And it was the same way with my wife's family in Limerick. They milked cows up until 89 was when David sold his cows. But anyway, long story short point, I'll get on my soapbox and you won't get to talk what you wanted to talk about.
Well, the part of Paul Harvey's piece where he says a farmer is someone who might stay out late for a school board meeting kind of makes me think of you. You've been a citizen activist since you realized since you were a young farmer, but then at a different level when you realized that your farm milk was contaminated by PFAS in 2016. I wonder what part of his speech that he gave there speaks to you today as you listen to it. You've heard it. You heard it when he first gave it, and you hear it again. And now with everything you know about PFAS
I think it has to do about doing the right thing. And I guess that's sometimes easier said than done. And I don't look at ourselves as being activists. I was involved in Maine Farm Bureau and American Farm Bureau, and then we dropped out of it. And so I was involved in it on a national level and in all kinds of national boards and what have you. But I never really looked at ourselves as being an activist. That was a moniker that we really didn't, I believed, had the time to do. We were always looking out because we were trying to make our operations better, or trying to look out for the well-being of our animals and our soils and what have you. So activism, I always thought that was a goal that you know, we really actually couldn't afford.
But you're a super professional on all these national boards and state boards.
Well, yeah, thank you. I appreciate that. I'm not so sure if everybody would agree with that assumption, but I'm sure we've made some interesting people along the way. But no, I mean, when we got a letter from Kenny McWater stating, and they gave us on November 3rd of 16, that the waters in the aquifer were contaminated, we immediately called our little management team together, and consisted of my wife, myself, my daughter, my son-in-law, one of my close friends was also my veterinarian, and our legal counsel, which is Lambert Coffin and John Lambert, came out and presented him with a letter that we got from Kenny McGuire, and because I'd never heard of PFAS or anything else about it, so this was all foreign to me. And I said, well, what do we do? And it all boiled down to, well, you have two choices. The first choice is that you say nothing because the state doesn't test for this stuff, and oblivion, you know, we have no clue. Or choice number two is you notify Oakhurst, you notify the state that there's a problem. Obviously, we chose, you know, number two. And it was an easy choice to make. I mean, you can't. It was the right choice, but it was the one you had to make. Although I have had people, since this has all come about, and you talk about a nuclear explosion going off, I mean, that was really one. We didn't really know it at the time, but we do now. And have told me, you know, Freddie, he said, you really screwed up. He said, and all I had to do was keep your mouth shut. He said, it's not like you have to eat the meat or drink the milk. Well, I have a real problem with that. I mean, these were people in our industry, both conventional and organic operations, that told me this. And I probably had a lower appreciation of those folks afterwards. But I don't see what else you could have done. I mean, that was what my wife and we were taught to do. Again, going back to my father and Laura's father and mother, I mean, you just don't do stuff like that.
And back to what you said, you take care of the farm and it takes care of you.
I know what our health issues are now, and I would not, you cannot do that. I mean, you just can't. I mean, it's illegal, of course, to sell adulterated food, which is what boils down to, but you can't do it morally, I guess is where I was going with that. So I know, folks have said, well, it takes a lot of courage to do that. Well, I don't know. I think probably people are giving us a lot more credit than probably they should. And after all the bloodletting that's gone on, and there's been a lot of it, and a lot of tears and everything else have gone by the wayside, it was still the right thing to do, and I will stand by my decision, or our decision, both my wife and myself's decision, that we did the right thing and not look back. It's awful hard because now the farm is a train wreck, and it's not even a shadow of what we had or what we had worked and my father and grandfather had worked towards. I told somebody, I said, the hardest part of this whole thing is going to be that when I pass away, I'm going to have a long talk with my father and grandfather, and when they ask me what happened to the farm they entrusted me with, and I'm going to have to tell them what had happened to the farm that they entrusted me with. And that's going to be a hard conversation, although knowing my grandfather and father, I know they would understand, but yeah, that's a hard one to come to grips with.
Maybe they already know.
And it's going to be a lot harder for other people too, so.
Yeah. You were a nationally recognized award-winning dairy farmer. I wonder if you could tell us how you got professionally involved with becoming a licensed sludge spreader and how that story unfolded for you.
That actually came about in 1983. We were involved with my father and the farm. We were involved with what was called the Tree Farm Organization, which was an offshoot of S.D. Warren. And the idea was you farm the forest, you farm the trees the same way you did your crops and what have you. And so they used to have the triangle signs with your name on it and even put it in front of your woodlots. And again, they were managed the same way. So I think my father had gone to one of their picnics or what have you, and they were talking about using biosolids or what have you as soil amendments. And we were always proactive, cutting-edge technologies and stuff. I mean, everybody thinks AI is new, but we were doing AI in 46. Back then, we were using fresh semen and stuff, and all of Maine and all the states had their own breeding co-ops. So it's AI is
not new.
So right. Mm-hmm. So that gives you an idea of the thing. So that was how we actually started, and we signed up along with other folks or the farms that did for that very reason, because when you're growing crops and your land and stuff, you're trying to cut your cost of production. I mean, it's a business. I mean, at the end of the day, your books have to balance. And so anything you can do to, A, improve the soil conditions, and B, cut your cost of production, then that you're going to do that, obviously.
Seems like a win-win.
So it was a win-win situation. They use lime as a neutralizing agent. Soils tend to run acidic because they're heavier clay soils. So, yeah, I mean, that was the thing to do. And we did that, I think, for a year or two with S.D. Warren, and then DEP was running around advocating sludge spreading, working with the municipality, because we were doing our civic duty. With us, it was Kennebunk.
Can I just interrupt for a second? So human feces becomes sludge when you take the water out.
Right.
How does sludge have PFAS in it?
That's an easy answer to answer, because what happens, the PFAS chemical itself is a derivative from your nonstick cookware, the water repellent in your clothing, what have you. So what happens is that as you do your laundry, as you wash your dishes and things of that nature, all of the gray water and wastewater then goes into your septic tanks, or if you're on a town, then it goes into but it eventually will make its way to a septic system, whether you're out in the country or wherever you are. When you have your septic tanks pumped, that's where that stuff goes. So as you start to consolidate or combine those, you then now, because this chemical likes to stick itself to organic matter, it will then attach itself, and it just condenses and condenses and condenses. Again, I've learned a lot more about this material than I'd ever wanted to.
Mom would be proud of your science education you've gotten as an adult.
Right. Stupidity does have a lot of advantages, I think, sometimes. So what happens in this scenario is that once those are combined and what have you, then they do the dewatering at the municipality, then now you're going, you're spreading this material on your fields, so which is all well and good. Your fields start off, we'll say at zero, and fill it for easy things. Then the first year you spread it, it might be a 10. I'm just using these as
10 parts
biotic
per
numbers,
trillion
but of, I'm just, yeah. these aren't the correct numbers, but as an example, this is how this would work.
Yep.
So, and because they're forever chemicals, meaning they don't dissipate, they tend to multiply. So it would be, what I mean by multiply is every year that you spread, so the number is 10, next 20, then it's 30, then it's 40, and because it doesn't dissipate, it doesn't go anywhere, it stays there, but it's consumed by the plant and what have you, so that you're feeding your cows or what have you, or yourselves, but the chemical doesn't move. It stays where it is and continues to compile. It's, i.e. why they call it a forever chemical, because it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
When we use fertilizers or sprays or herbicides or pesticides on our fields, they dissipate. They go away. These don't. They stay where they are.
And they also grow up into the plants that you then feed
right.
your cattle, and into the water that you also feed your cattle.
Right.
And then into the cattle.
And then you're spreading it around because everybody's consuming it. So the cows, I think when right after we did our thing in 16 and the water level is what it was, and we notified the state. State came out and did a test because it passed because, again, state doesn't test for this. Oakhurst ran a milk sample in December. I think it was the first week of December. The samples came back at that time. Vista Analyticals was one of the, in California, was one of the really only accredited labs that would handle this. There was a few other ones, but Vista's the one that everybody was using. So anyway, the milk level came back at over 1,400, and that would have been milk we'd been shipping to Oakhurst right along, okay?
And the standard of safety.
And, well, at that time, they didn't have a standard of safety. They were using the EPA number of 75, which was what, and that was for water, and that was only their recommendation, I might add, too. So, it's since come way down. State's number is 20, although EPA's number is still 75, but the state's number is 20. A milk number is 210 now. For milk in the state of Maine, but that was based on 75 being the water number. So that number has to come down. Whether they've done that yet or not, I don't know. And it would also be the same way with the soils and stuff, because there is a safe number in the soils and in the plants. And now you're finding it in game animals. And, of course, that's got everybody in a tether, which they should be in a tether about.
Yep. Your numbers were way over. If you're just joining this conversation, welcome. You're listening to What Mama Wants. I'm Kate Manahan, and my guest today is Fred Stone. We're talking about PFAS, a class of more than, oh gosh, there's so many different numbers, 30,000 chemicals, man-made chemical compounds that don't break down in our environment or in our bodies. Fred applied sludge to his field and other farmers' fields starting in 1983, and the Maine Department of Environmental Protection said, don't worry, it won't hurt you. But it did hurt you. Can you explain a little bit about what toxic PFAS chemicals that were mixed with the sludge have since done to your health and your farm?
Yep. On the personal level, on the health-wise, your number or anybody else's number, if they were to do a serum test on you, should be at a 2 or 4. My number is 111. My wife's number is 91. My daughter and my son's number is less than 50. But the problem with my son and my daughter's numbers is that they were contaminated or poisoned, as I like to call it. I know that gets everybody in a dither when I say poisoned, but look up the definition. But they were poisoned as adolescents, where my wife and I were as adults. And it's a lot worse when you're an adolescent than it is when you're an adult for this chemical. So, and then we also, my wife and my daughter and my son and myself, have all of the health issues that are tied to this chemical. Hence why, another reason why we couldn't go and ship our contaminated milk or contaminated product to anybody. As far as the farm itself is concerned, it's a financial train wreck. We ended up slaughtering about 80% of the herd. We have probably about 30 animals left. I mean, these are cow families we just can't kill. So we can show them, because my friend can write my health charts, I can take them anywhere, because they're contaminated and not contagious. I'll back up and say that we did, at the initial start of this whole mess, our goal was to salvage the operation, salvage the herd, which is meetings that we had with our lender and Oakhurst, or John Bennett from Oakhurst, which is now owned by DFA, but that's another story, and our attorney, John Lambert. We met, and we were going to do whatever it took to salvage the operation. Hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars later, we found out that, it just didn't work. Mm-hmm. We initially pulled the plug officially in February of 19, and I think we officially came out, if you want to say come out of the closet, I guess, on March of 19 when we had our news conference at the farm stating that this was a big problem and why. But financially, we've received very little help, very little anything. My son-in-law has set up a GoFundMe thing, which has actually helped a lot. And I know there are other organizations that are out there that are maybe soliciting contributions and stuff. My recommendation is to find the farmer that you want to help and support them directly and forget the middleman. The state, in their infinite wisdom, is supposed to be able to help us in some respects, and I guess maybe they will. Right now, they're drunk with pandemic money up there, so that's probably going to be a good thing. USDA will help us now with the dead cows, I guess, but that took a lot of mashing of teeth and what have you with our delegation, our Washington delegation, to get those things passed. I mean, again, this has got very many layers, and I understand that it's awful hard to capsulize this in a radio show, because this thing is, this, you get into it, it makes your hair hurt. It really does.
My hair is aching. We're on the brink of becoming the first state, Maine is, to ban the spreading of sludge with LD-1911, which is sitting on the governor's desk presently, waiting for her signature. And this is a really big step. It's getting national attention. You've worked closely with the Earth as a lifelong dairy farmer. I wonder what you imagine Mother Earth might want now. What does Mama want in relationship to PFAS?
That's a difficult question to answer. I could have answered that question very easily on November 2nd of 16.
What would you have said then?
What I would have said then was that it would be the way that we were handling our soils and handling our farm back then, because it was a combination of everything else. I know the organic people go off and us conventional farmers go off, but it's always been a combination of the two. Mm-hmm. It has never been one thing or the other in my mind. And I guess that goes back to the technology and what have you. As far as the thing is now, this was right out of the blue. I'm not sure how and you're going to clean up those fields and those soils in that situation. And again, I've run out of tears. I go out in that field, and those are fields that I was running around as a little kid, and I'm out in those same fields now. And it, again, I've run out of tears because I run out of crying. It just bothers us that much. And I'm pissed, so I guess that's the best way of putting
it. After you're super sad, you move on to other feelings. Fred, you are a real-life hero for speaking up about the contamination on your farm, even though it spelled out ruin for you and your family. You're a fierce advocate for food safety and for justice in general. Thank you so much for using your one powerful, authentic voice to shine a light on the issue of PFAS in our lives, and may you and your family soon receive some relief for this dystopian story that you're living.
Very good. Thank you very much for your interest and concerns in this. Again, and there are other farms that are just as bad as we are. So yes.
Thank you for joining us here on What Mama Wants today.